This is Fresh Air. As far as the virus is concerned, we human beings are just a handy way to reproduce. That's one unpleasant observation in a new book about viral research called A Dancing Matrix. The book is by medical writer Robin Marantz Hennig. AIDS has increased our fears about what new viruses are out there. But Hennig says emerging viruses aren't necessarily new. They're usually just new to the region or the species.
We usually think of something new as being more like the Andromeda strain, you know, something that fell from space and that's some new mutant that maybe some scientist did deliberately to infect a population he didn't like. But in fact, the viruses that will threaten us in the future are out there right now, sort of peacefully cohabitating in the environment that they currently are existing in. And what will be different about them, what will be threatening, is that they will move to a new population. They'll cross borders. They'll move into a new geography or into a new species, and it will infect a population that has never seen the virus before, and it won't be used to it immunologically. It won't be able to fight it in the way that the coexisting population had been able to.
Why are viruses so much harder to kill than bacteria?
They're much more of a parasite than bacteria is. A bacterium is actually a living thing that can reproduce on its own and then can do all the things that you think a life form needs to do. A virus can't do anything on its own. The only way that it can reproduce is by getting into a cell and sort of tricking the cell's reproductive machinery into making more viruses instead of making more cells. So that means that the virus is very intimately connected with the workings of a healthy cell. So to find something that will kill a virus, we also are likely to damage the cell itself. It's just much harder to come up with an antiviral agent as a result of that.
What are some of the things that you learned about the characteristics of HIV, the AIDS virus?
Well, I guess something that I learned in doing the book that I didn't realize before is that it's basically, now at least, a chronic illness, so that somebody can carry HIV for many years, 10 years, sometimes even more, and can be passing it on during all that time. You know, at first you look at it and you think, well, here is this virus that's totally dependent on its host to keep it alive, to reproduce for it and to keep it alive. How can it be so uniformly lethal? Because once it kills its host, it has to die out too. Well, the brilliance of HIV, if you can anthropomorphize like that, is that it hides for such a long time and has this long chronic period, this long latent period, so that the carrier feels healthy enough to transmit it. And there's many opportunities for transmission. And so then the virus does just fine at multiplying in somebody else's body before the original carrier gets too sick to pass it on.
What are some of the characteristics of HIV that have made it a virus that is spread through body fluids but not spread through coughs and sneezes? It's not an airborne virus.
Well, viruses seem to have a propensity towards going to a particular kind of cell. This is something called tropism. So some viruses go into the lung and become sort of carried on the droplets that come out of the lung when you cough. This is how, you know, influenza is spread, how measles is spread, because they are tropic to the respiratory system. HIV is tropic to the immune system and the blood, and blood cells, so that's the only way that it can be transmitted. It hasn't developed the capacity to infect the respiratory system.
You raise a question in your book about whether viruses can cause chronic diseases and whether there can be conditions that a lot of people have that nobody has connected yet to a virus, mm-hmm. but might actually be caused by a virus. What kinds of conditions were you thinking about when you wrote that? What kinds of conditions are being questioned now?
Well, there are some big surprises. There are some chronic conditions that people never think have anything to do with an infectious disease that have been sort of associated in some studies with certain viruses. For example, heart conditions, atherosclerosis, the buildup of plaque in the arteries, seems to be connected with cytomegalovirus, CMV. Basically all that people know right now is that people or animals who have CMV infection seem to be more prone to developing plaque buildup in their arteries. And I don't know exactly what can be made of this kind of a finding. You know, CMV, for example, is a ubiquitous virus. Almost everybody's exposed to it by the time they become adults, so that a cause and effect relationship will be very difficult to prove. But if somehow you can develop a vaccine against CMV so that you get antibodies and don't really need, you know, can't really get exposure to the virus in a way that can damage your blood vessels, that would be so wonderful to be able to eliminate that cause of coronary artery disease.
Medical writer Robin Marantz-Hennig is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robin Marantz-Hennig. She's a medical writer who's written a new book about viruses called A Dancing Matrix. Robin, did you get flu shots while researching your book on viruses?
I actually didn't. I was convinced by what I was reading that the protection that you get from a flu shot is limited. If you get a flu shot, and if it does happen to contain protection against the flu virus that we actually are exposed to that year, which is only a 50-50 proposition, that protection is only going to last for about a year. If you allow yourself to get influenza, which is, you know, not fun, but not life-threatening if you're basically healthy, then your immune protection will more likely last 3 or 4 years. The flu virus changes slightly from 1 year to another, which is why people need to get new flu shots every year if they are getting flu shots. But it changes slightly, you know, the changes are small enough that the antibodies that you've built up to last year's flu, if you've built them up naturally, will probably protect you from the slight variation in next year's flu. If you build them up as a result of the flu shot, though, for some reason, the antibodies just aren't as robust, and you really have to get the shot again year after year.
How does a vaccine trick a body into creating an immunity to it?
Well, there are different ways that different vaccines work. Some of them will actually contain the virus, either in a killed form. In other words, it doesn't have any of the guts, but it has sort of the outside shell of the virus. Or else they'll contain it in what's called an attenuated form, which is a weakened form. In either case, the virus can't make you sick, but it can make your immune system see something as a foreign intruder and go into action, which is to build up antibodies that fit perfectly against this foreign intruder. That's what your body will do if it gets an actual virus infection, too. But usually, the virus can multiply very, very rapidly, and your antibody response takes several days to really get going. And that's the period during which you get sick. If your antibody response gets going in response to this weakened virus or this killed virus, then the antibodies are sort of there for life, ready for the next onslaught of virus, so that when you get infected for real next time, the antibodies are already there, and the virus doesn't have a chance to start replicating in large enough amounts to make you really sick.
Mm-hmm. Why is there so much guesswork involved with creating a flu vaccine each year?
It's hard to know in which direction the flu changes are likely to go. The best that people can do is try to go to the source of our influenza. Every year in China or other countries of Asia, there is an influenza outbreak about 6 months to a year before that same outbreak occurs here. So we've actually got flu watchers who go to Asia and try to track down precisely what kind of virus is infecting the population there, and then rush back to the United States and try to make a vaccine against that precise arrangement of viruses. What happens in Asia, too, is this goes back to what we were talking about before, about what human beings do that set up conditions for new viruses to occur. In Asia, they often farm in a way that puts different species of animals in proximity to each other. And these animals are all capable of harboring a human influenza virus. So you've often got, say, ducks and pigs on the same farm that might be co-infected with the same with different strains of a human influenza virus. Because the flu virus is so easily mutated, because it sort of rearranges itself so easily. If you've got a duck and a pig together, they might take their different human influenza viruses and mix them up, sort of like you're shuffling a deck of cards, and come out with some totally new arrangement that we haven't seen before. That's you know, the beginning of a totally new strain of influenza and the beginning of a pandemic flu. And all the pandemics that we've had in the past seem to have originated in Asia, because that's where these animals cohabitate.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you have to say that's good about viruses?
They are basically, they've been called a piece of bad news wrapped in protein. And certainly when they make you sick, it feels as though there's nothing good about them. But scientists have been able to use viruses almost to domesticate viruses and use them to their own purposes. The most dramatic example is gene therapy, where basically what they do is take a virus, which has a brilliant way of getting inside of a particular cell, and instead of having the virus genes inside of it, they strip out the virus gene so that the virus itself is harmless, and put in whatever human gene is desired to get into that cell, a gene carrying a particular enzyme that an individual might be lacking, or a gene carrying a tumor-fighting protein that a cancer patient might need. And then they infuse that virus back into the patient, and the virus actually helps the gene get to the spot where it's supposed to be. So to that extent, viruses can sort of be harnessed in a way, and their own tricks can be used to humans' benefits.
You raise a disturbing possibility in the book, and I'm curious how widespread fear of this is in the scientific community. That now that we have several conditions that incapacitate the immune system, including AIDS, and including temporarily people who get organ transplants because the immune system is suppressed so that the body doesn't reject the new organ, why are we creating circumstances that are conducive to viruses mutating in a way that might be really dangerous to us in the future?
Yeah, there are several scientists who are concerned about that, who are worried that you'll, for example, insert a kidney into an individual, and then to keep the person from rejecting the kidney, you have to give them immune suppressant drugs, and yet the kidney is carrying some ostensibly harmless virus like cytomegalovirus that isn't even tested for because everybody's got it. But once you've got the transplant recipient who is immune suppressed, that cytomegalovirus can indeed start multiplying in a way that's sort of abnormal because it's not in a normal human body, and it can mutate and can create a new variant of cytomegalovirus that isn't harmless anymore. There are some scientists who are rather concerned about that. And then there's a new concern that isn't even in the book because it's too recent. When we start transplanting animal organs into human beings, which is happening in just, you know, very, very few cases now, but if that were to become more common, then we'd be actually putting in to an immunocompromised person, because we've given him those immune suppressant drugs, an animal virus. And who knows what the result of that could be.
When you were researching viruses, did you start imagining viruses everywhere?
I started to get a little nervous about what it was that we could do to protect ourselves. It seemed as though everything that humans did had some sort of a viral impact, and we weren't really taking it into account. You know, we know that progress has an environmental cost, but I don't think people had realized that it also has a public health cost. The only thing that saved me from getting really frantic was thinking that there are now, for the first time, some scientists who are also thinking along these lines and who are trying to make some sort of a coordinated effort to stay one step ahead of whatever new virus is likely to come along the pike. I don't think that we'll be quite as surprised by the next sudden new epidemic as we were about the AIDS epidemic. I think that people's level of suspicion has been raised, and that if we see just a few new cases of something that can't quite be explained, that I hope that some international effort will be mounted to try to track down its cause more quickly than we did the last time.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Robin Morantz-Hennig is the author of the new book, A Dancing Matrix, Voyages Along the Viral Frontier. This is Fresh Air.